Okay, that means we've got a good 50 minutes for questions, comments, criticisms, etc., etc. So I can open up the floor now for... Yes?
Yeah, in the, all these papers, I've always been... Because in a certain sense, especially Alex, is trying to say that forms of discourse about globalization in international relations, cosmopolitanism, of a liberal democratic bent, or social democratic bent, or somebody like Held and others, she's rather close to anarchism. But really, aren't you just saying that if you take a libertarian social democrat, which is essentially what he is, you know, with decentralization, federalization, and he's just a nice, cuddly guy, and you take him a bit further, I mean, eventually you become, you know, if you drop this out and add that, you become an anarchist. Well, you know, that's an older argument about the similarities between forms of, you know, liberal socialism or the third way of stuff that people talk about, not Tony Blair's form, but things before him. So, that's not so unique, but I think what's interesting is that this has been continued. Now, have you ever read the work of Mervyn Frost, who's an ethical man who does that? He wrote a wonderful little book, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow very briefly, which is, this came out this year. He's written lots of other books, but this little one, which is really about ethics, and he's got this idea of the two anarchies, one anarchy being, you know, what you were talking about, the anarchy of states, and there's no, and another anarchy of global civil society, and how in some ways they kind of balance each other out. And he's getting close to a theory which reinforces Held and takes him a bit further towards what you're talking about.
Thanks. I'll check that out. Mm. I don't know. I guess maybe it wasn't clear in the presentation. I mean, I'm not trying to say that, you know, sort of systemic today global social democrats are closer to anarchism. I mean, maybe I am. I'm saying that they're all much closer to anarchism than they're willing to recognise. Part of the reason is, of course, that they don't engage with the anarchist arguments, so they're doomed to repeat them if they get any closer.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, so you find that people that are veering away from sort of classic, you know, Trotskyist position to trying to accept their autonomy and other people in the working class might be have something to do with history, and then they veer away ever so slightly from the state. Well, they're obviously veering towards an anarchist perspective.
Right.
I mean, these are the two grand traditions on the left during the last 200 years. So it's inevitable that if they start dumping their own principles, they're going to start finding out.
Right.
And the problem is that because they don't know that history, because the history of anarchists, the historiography of anarchism has been so muddied by classic Stalinist hacks all the way through to the last decade. People don't really know the traditions there. It's a real shame. So I guess this paper is trying to use Held as a jumping-off point for trying to make anarchism less scary for people who are basically doing this stuff anyway.
Well, I'm going to add, you know, there's Laclau and what's her name?
Laclau and Mouffe.
I mean, in their work, basically, they are people coming from a Marxist tradition, and what they end up with this agonism and these different things, is really a form of, again, libertarian socialism. But, you know, they're coming from this world of, you know, we're scientific socialism, these people are wackos, so we can't admit it, we have to use all this theological nonsense, you know, from various different philosophies to explain it without just saying, yeah, that's what, you know, somebody said this a long time ago. The other person, of course, is G.D.H. Cole in his six-volume History of Socialism, which, of course, came from field social. He was old, he knew the tradition, and at the end of it, writing in about 1958, he's saying, oh, it's very nice, we have a welfare state, we have the NHS, all the rest of it, but there's something wrong with it, and that's this bureaucracy that's developing in society, and military dominance and all the rest of it.
Yeah, Paul Hurst is another one. That's...
And he says, you know, we should rediscover the solvent of anarchism or something to that effect. But of course, he knew about it.
Yeah.
As a young man, he was close to syndicalism. So, yes, I mean, I see what you're getting at. Yeah.
It's probably more a question that relates to Shannon and Adam's pieces, but I kind of felt that. I may have got it wrong, but I felt you did seem to be relying upon a notion of the human subject as essentially good or essentially prone to mutual aid, as Kropotkin argued and a number of other classical anarchists argued. And I suppose if you are proposing that, then there's a number of other problems that I'd have with a I suppose maybe if you clarified that first before I start ranting about.
Well, I mean, at least from my point of view in terms of the paper, at least I don't go into those questions. I try to deliberately sort of circumvent them. So there isn't, well, there shouldn't seem to be an assumption of, you know, the perfect human subject, that's the, you know, some ideal trait, but rather goes to forms of social cooperation that can happen at the local and global spheres as being at least ethically superior, but without saying that there is, you know, some nominal view of the subject that has to underpin that.
With me, it's I'm trying to get away from, you know, the arguments for essentializing. I find that you know, they're obviously not accepted well, and but I think at the same time, when you can say, well, humans are inherently good because cooperation occurs, I don't think it's an, like a logical conclusion. I think cooperation occurs regardless of these kind of you know, individually based normative implications of what is good and what is evil. And in fact, I don't really buy that dichotomy myself. So it's not an essentializing argument. It's an ontological argument, and from that we can determine from that point on, you know, how cooperation takes place, because the argument is inevitably will take place, regardless of, you know, but it's up to the individual to determine the forms that the cooperation takes place in. So there's no human nature per se, and I don't think Kropotkin's trying to argue that there is a particular human nature. It's a matter of looking at how interactions take place and what are the ontological implications because of that. Is that clear?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's very, very clearly coming out against the social Darwinists, mm-hmm. in the paper that you describe, you know, mm-hmm. and he is pretty much saying this is an alternative view of human nature to contrast against the social. But yeah,
I wouldn't rely on that argument myself, and that's why I see such value in critical realism, because of the questions of ontology. They're so much more important than the questions of what is human nature.
Can I just add something to that? Is that right? Because Kropotkin wrote a really interesting book called Ethics, and it's basically it's an approach to ethics that is informed by evolutionary biology, basically. I mean, the trite point to make is that bad people cooperate too, right? So the point that I think he's trying to make in that book is that is that it's the form of sociality within which we exist, if you like, that pretty much predetermines the sorts of people we will become. Yeah? So our good and bad natures can only be decided within those specific social forms. So social forms with states will make subjects with particular conceptions of good and bad, and so on. Social forms without states will do different things. Yeah? And that's always going to be relative to the social form, not to the individual. So it's not human nature, but the social form that determines the shape of ethics. I think that ties in more to people like Alistair MacIntyre and sort of virtue ethicists and neo-Aristotelians, rather than the sort of, you know, the anti-essentialists or the sort of liberal approach to the individual.
Yes.
My comment actually relates to your question as well. And I don't really agree with this dichotomy that you have between sociality and cooperation on the one hand, and individuality and natural selection acting on the individual on the other hand. Now, I'm an ecologist, so I'll talk more from an evolutionary biology perspective, but cooperation does not necessarily have to come because individuals are good. Cooperation can also be a byproduct of selfish action, because it will increase the fitness of the individual, meaning it will increase individuals' reproductive success. Meaning that for some animals, and first of all, cooperation doesn't occur in all animals. Only social groups only occur in some groups of animals. So for some groups of animals, it will increase the individual's fitness or reproductive success if they cooperate. And therefore, cooperation does not have to be a contrast. It's either competition on the one hand, or if you look at individual fitness, it will breed in competition. Whereas if you look at the species level, you'll see cooperation. It's not necessarily opposites. On the contrary, these things are really connected. And that's all connected to the concept of byproduct mutualism, where things will happen just because they're beneficial. But what's called beneficial doesn't mean that the individual itself will gain, just means that the individual will pass more genes to future generations. So although social Darwinism has a a lot of problems, and the neo-Darwinian synthesis has been used in quite erroneous way in the past. I don't necessarily think you should negate this way of thinking, because it can actually promote anarchist thoughts and anarchist ideas.
No, that's an interesting point. And I'm with you in that obviously it's not a strict dichotomy, and I guess I do come across as kind of characterizing it as such. But it's fascinating. I'll have to have a chat with you later about it. Yeah.
Yes. Actually, I think it's been a long time since I've been through the whole book, but I think in the first 9 pages or so of Mutual Aid, Kropotkin does say that it's not strictly mutual struggle and it's not strictly mutual aid, but it's a combination of the both. And what I got from that is that it's a combination of both on an individual level and on a group level, you know. Right. But I don't know if he exactly said that.
No, he just saw it. Can I continue?
You go ahead.
I mean, on the... Sorry, is that the last question? But, I mean, it's interesting you bring that up, because...
We both hold that thought.
Yeah, or find it again.
Come back to it. Yes.
I have a great deal of sympathy with Via Campesina. I really enjoy following that movement. Lots of local organizations within Via Campesina. But I'm a little bit worried that the main proponent of Via Campesina in Scandinavia is a Maoist. And the leading members of the network in Scandinavia tend to be like very conservative peasant unions. And it also tends to be, when Via Campesina are participating in activities in the Netherlands or Germany or Scandinavia, the outcome or the results normally tend to be calls for against free trade, but in a manner which means that American or African or Asian farmers are excluded from the European market. You see my line of argument. Or could be a little bit more critical towards the outcome we've seen on that one. And also, thinking about finance, the biggest financer in Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Germany are NGOs. And approximately 90% of the funds they are using come from the government. Should also be cause for concern. I don't know if you'd like to reflect on that.
Yeah, the thing with Via Campesina is that it is a diverse movement, so there are different interests, particularly with the European peasant movement as opposed to the rest of. So I wouldn't say it's some monolithic entity with one interest. So it's competing within itself. But from my perspective, it's the fact that there is. Within this large network, those engagements between each other and difference of opinion sort of reflected in a non-hierarchical fashion, that is the key benefit. But again, I'm not saying that the actual interests behind it are all the same and they're all pulling in one direction. I wouldn't make that claim, but it's the fact that it's a form of local and global solidarities that's of interest. But I also wouldn't claim that in terms of the actual claims that certain parts are making, as you suggest in terms of the European context, where it does seem to ally with the interests of local farmers for protectionism, is something that should be advanced either. But it's more in that loose organisational form, which I think is the benefit. But you'd have to make a strict demarcation between the two. But the thing is, there's so many different parts of La Via Campesina that it's always shifting and changing, so perhaps over time there might be a movement away from that within itself.
Do you remember what you were going to say?
No, I don't remember. Okay.
We'll move on anyway.
If someone else has got a question that hasn't spoken yet, I'll wait.
I think you're free to go.
So this is more in reference to Alex's piece, which is kind of on a similar track, just because this is So one of the big similarities between classical anarchism and liberalism tends to be a reliance on the autonomy of the the individual, like that we can retain this concept of a completely autonomous individual that's capable of making decisions, and for liberals, in order for there to be equality, then that autonomous individual needs to be have a relationship with the state. It can't be, can't have, and so you can have equality in relation to the state, but it's not in relation to everyone else. You can have some people have more equality or more freedom than others because it's not a relation to each other, it's a relation to the state. So anarchists, classical anarchists, have to rely, because they are mobilizing this concept of the autonomous individual subject, they have to rely on some essentialized notion of the human subject as good, because otherwise how is everyone going to get along with each other? And so I think that is a key similarity between classical anarchism and liberalism. But I also think it's a big problem, and I think it's, rather than looking to the ways in which we're similar, we need to think, okay, how do we reconceptualize the autonomy of, how do we reconceptualize autonomy so that it doesn't rely on either essentialized humans or state relations? So I was just wondering if the individual that you're talking about is an autonomous individual, or is it relational, is it mutually constituted, whatever?
Basically, I think you might be confusing sort of liberal understandings of the autonomous individual with an anarchist conception of autonomy, which basically presupposes not the individual, but the social forms within which an individual participates with other individuals.
But so it still presupposes an individual.
Hang on a second. Because I think the point was made by Adam that it's the social is primary. Okay, it comes before the individual, right? So when we're looking, so for example, I have a couple of quotes I mentioned, right? for David Held, then autonomy is not something the individual has, but it's a principle which governs the way in which the rules with which we coordinate our actions ought to be devised. For Proudhon, it's pretty much the same. The point of autonomy is not because we are autonomous individuals, it's that we need to build institutions that allow us to realise a degree of autonomy. It makes no presuppositions about what the individual's like, because that's really not the important thing. The important thing is the way in which society allows particular forms of individuality to be expressed. So, like I said, the state societies necessitate classic individuals with sovereign rights and so on and so forth, yeah? Because of the way in which that society is constituted, that form of individual will emerge, right? Because the society is prior to the individual. We're always born into societies. We always grow up in them. We don't actually wake up one day and choose to be autonomous individuals. We're simply not. And I think one of the problems with the way in which, for example, post-anarchism reads classical anarchism is to conflate a reading of sort of reductionist sort of economistic Marxism back onto classical anarchism and tries to find the same sort of critiques back there. But that individual, or that approach to the individual, simply doesn't exist in classical anarchism. Now, if you want to, for example, Rousseau is the classic guy who says that the individual is basically good and the problem is society. And all we've got to do is remove society and the individual will realise his ultimate flourishing, blah, blah, blah. And the anarchists simply never said that. Okay, when Rousseau said that, everyone ridiculed him. Okay, I'm not saying that nobody read him or anything as a result. He was one of the most influential people around. But the point is that was Rousseau's position, not the anarchist's position. The anarchists, for them, society was always prior. The individual is something that emerged out of society. So that the character of that individual, whether it's autonomous or not, was dependent on the society in which it lived. It was never some essentialized abstract individual in any of the anarchists, classical anarchists.
But aren't you just doing an essentialized society? I mean, is there a methodological individualism in classical anarchism?
I don't think so, no. I've never found it. I don't think the classical anarchists were methodologically rigorous enough to be able to put that methodological individualism together.
I think Malatesta did, yeah.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I think the classical anarchists were more interested in social forms, and they were only interested in individuality insofar as it was restrained by particular social forms, and particular forms of individuals and groups emerged under particular social conditions. I mean, that's why they had revolutions, to overturn society, not to transform individuals. You know, you look at the utopian socialists, for example. I mean, they were obsessed with changing individuals. For them, it was all about changing man from being this repressed individual to being free love and veganism and all the rest of them. Well, no problem with vegans, of course, but I mean, this has been around for a long time. And the point was to emancipate the individual, particularly women, because the individual was good on the inside. That's what the utopian socialists did. It's not what the anarchists did. I mean, for Bakunin, if you look at the way he understood Pan-Slavism, he was looking at the way in which, by removing states, a social form would emerge, an organic and social form, but never an organic individual. Pan-Slavism was never about one person or a pre-social individual that would emerge out of the rural states. It was always a social form, and I don't think it centralizes either.
That's when he wasn't an anarchist.
Bakunin?
And that when he was Pan-Slavist.
Okay.
He left that behind.
First of all, even like Emma Goldman, although she's not the classical anarchist, but she's a bit older style anarchist, she even talked about the fact about individuals and how important it is for individuals to be liberated in order for society to be free. So there were people who did talk about liberation and even on a very personal level. But back to what I was saying, actually, which really answers this, is that the individual doesn't have to be, there's no such thing as essential nature or human nature. The individual does not necessarily need to be good in order to cooperate, when you know that cooperation is beneficial for the individual. So the individual could be as spiteful and egoistic as you like, and cooperation can still emerge. So it's not that you need an essential human nature for cooperation to emerge, it can be the natural state of cooperation emerging. And that's especially for animals or any species that rely on one each other in order to exist or to survive in their environment.
But sorry, I raised my hand or anything. But doesn't it matter what the species is and the ecology in which they exist? Because, one of the main critiques that, what's his name? He wrote about Malthusianism in Darwin's writings. He looked at the places that Darwin went when he came to his conclusions about natural selection, and they were tropical coastal environments, whereas Kropotkin went into Siberia in the interior, where it was just like a horrendous cold, like very harsh environment, right? So I think you can't really kind of universalize whether it's cooperation or competition. You have to be context and situation dependent, right? So, behavior is driven to an extent by material circumstances. So, I can't remember where I was going with that, but
I totally agree with what you said, that obviously different environments will result in different situations arising, different interactions. But I think what it is actually, a lot of what you were writing and your criticism of Darwinism was really related to old-style Darwinism, mm-hmm. whereas new thoughts in behavioral ecology actually look at it from a totally different perspective. Mm-hmm. Now the focus is actually that it's not competition as in one individual fighting each other. Mm-hmm. It is actually survival in a harsh environment, limited mm-hmm. resources.
Yeah.
But intra-specific competition is not fighting with your fellow species members, but it's more the fact that because you have some qualities that means that you have more offspring, it means that in the end of the day, you will do better in the future and affect future generations more than your neighbor, rather than you actually fighting your neighbor. So competition is actually now perceived in a very different way, and especially because of the genetic synthesis into evolution. So I think harsh environment and these concepts are now a lot stronger than the past concept where people actually thought that everything is about one fighting each other. So things have evolved as well on the evolution argument.
But, I would agree. I mean, there's a lot of nuance. You've got Lewontin writing about, the triple helix, right? The idea, epigenetics, how the environment affects, the behavior, and it's not all reducible to the gene. But it's not a consensus. Granted, ecological, behavioral ecology and whatnot—it's important. But I guess I was using my critique of this old-style Darwinism, or even the synthesis, the neo-Darwinian synthesis, based on how it's perceived and how it's being applied to the social sciences. You know, and I find it repugnant that it's been used to shore up realist arguments. You know, and there's a lot of misconceptions about it that just completely they miss the finer nuances. You know, so I think we're talking on the same page basically, but you know, the fact that this classical old style Darwinism, the perception of it still exists, really needs to be elucidated.
I think this is a point of interdisciplinary stuff, and it's actually between biological science and social science. It's not that complicated.
The anarchists did it, right?
Alex, you had a...
I have a question for Adam. You mentioned states as actors. You were talking about Bradley Thayer.
Right.
I was just wondering if you could sort of unpack, because central to this is a critique of a sort of a statist way of understanding the world, where the states are the key actors, right? But in some points in your presentation, you kind of slipped back into that language. Uh-huh. And I was just wondering whether you kind of like to reflect on a statist ontology, how what you've done here might undermine it, how it would sit alongside it. Because it seems to me that, you know, states as actors are inherently problematic concepts.
Yeah, definitely. And the reason I kind of fell back on that terminology is because when I was touching on Thayer, you know, that's what he is. He adopts this statist ontology. But no, by no means should we consider the state a coherent actor that you know, it has homogeneous values and interests. In fact, and I think you asked me this along the similar lines, same question at the ISA in February. And I mean, it's completely right. You have to understand the state as a disaggregated kind of collective of coercive institutions. But you know, and I kind of ran it by you last night when we were at the pub, but you know, the line. we weren't working that hard, no. But the you know, you've got Weber's you know, definition of the state as you know, having a monopoly on violence, but I think it's more important to understand the state as having a monopoly on cooperation and affiliation and association. You know, if we understand the state as necessarily guiding our cooperative tendencies or centralizing them and acting as that, you know, mythical neutral arbiter, you know, I think that's more important to conceive of the state like that rather than merely having the monopoly on legitimate violence, right?
Maybe we end up paraphrasing Julia Kristeva, the status such does not exist. I've said that once. Did you? Yeah, they laughed. Stupid, of course. Okay, any further questions, comments? Well, we did start early.
Shall we
introduce
April online?
Oh, I can't. I'm having a lot of difficulties.
This is really, really crazy because I've spent 2 hours making sure that everything works, and I come in today and the webcam doesn't work. Literally, and it's a real travesty. But anyway, if we close early, then I can have coffee and I can try and figure out the webcam.
If the coffee will be there anyway. My last job as chair then is just to thank Adam, Alex, and Shannon for three very interesting papers, and congratulations.